thank you very much for the announcement. And we heard quite a lot about other applications of SLE, but the original motivation for introduction of SLE by Schramm was to sort of try to understand better scaling limits of two-dimensional lattice models. And we certainly can understand them much better now, but we haven't really progressed too much in really proving that certain lattice models converge to SLE. So there are essentially, well, only a few cases. So that's what I want to discuss. Conformal invariance in easing model, or more generally, in critical lattice models with nearest neighbor interactions. And the whole setup motivation for SLE, it works for lattice models where there is only, well, I don't know, spin models or random cluster models, but where there is only interaction between neighboring sides, because you then draw a curve which separates some neighbors and you want two things on two sides of the curve not to interact. So there are only a few cases when we know conformal invariance. So there is a percolation of triangular lattice, and then there is uniform spanning tree or loop erased random walk by Lowell, Schramm, and Lerner. And then there is a more recent work of Scott Sheffield and Eddard Schramm. It doesn't quite fit in this picture of lattice models with nearest neighbor interaction, but it's related, so it's harmonic explorer and discrete Gaussian free field. And that's more or less all what we have up to now. And what I want to talk about is...
As long as you don't specify what exactly is conformal invariant, I think the easing models should be there too.
I should give you a copy of my paper, because I very carefully worded this, because every physicist says that. So, I mean, 2 points. First, there is no mathematical proof of whatever being invariant, conformally invariant in Ising model. Well, at least there was no mathematical proof. And the second point, even physics arguments, some of them actually are rigorous, so some of them can be made in mathematical proof. They either apply to some very restricted boundary conditions, or to some domains like strips or half planes. So at best, they give evidence for modular invariance, or for Möbius invariance, which is arguably a much weaker property, because that you can also discuss in 3D, that some of these Möbius invariants. So I don't know, if you would give me a reference that something proves indeed that Ising model is fully conformally invariant, then I would be very glad to see. As for the certain quantities which are Möbius invariant in the limit, that I agree that there are physics papers which can be made in rigorous proofs. No doubt about it. That I fully agree. And here I more or less, well, you're correct, because if I'm speaking about just some function, some correlation function, then here, well, I should have mentioned anyway, it is a very important and earlier work of Kenyon, where he didn't prove that interfaces or some curves involved in the model have conformally invariant scaling limit, but he computed many things and showed them to be conformally invariant. So I should have said that. Indeed, this sort of raises a question: what is conformally invariant? So what? Conformal invariance of what, rather? Conformal invariance of. And there are several possibilities. So the first possibility is to discuss some observable, like a correlation function or a crossing probability, or when it's sort of clear what we mean by existence of conformally invariant scaling limit. So you take crossing probability, then you state that there is a limit, which is a number, which is conformally invariant, which only depends on conformal modulus of configuration. So that's some observable. And then there is a question, if we represent our model by collection of interfaces between, say, clusters and dual clusters, or between different spins or different pod states, is invariance of one interface. And then if there is conformal invariance, then it should basically curve. So that was the famous Schramm's observation. And the third thing is that we can try to describe not just one interface, but the full collection of interfaces, so that full scaling limit. So what I would try to do is to report a new work where I try to understand these things for all models, but well, for now I have proofs for Ising spin model and random cluster of Fortuyn-Kestelen representation of Ising model. So I will mainly speak about that one. Well, for several reasons, it's slightly more geometric and easier to speak about it. And I will try to show how one proves that there is something which is fully conformally invariant, and why, and that part already is model independent, why if you have point one, you would have automatically points two and three.
So just a point of terminology. Are they going to be conformally covariant, really?
Who? Models
observables?
Well, I mean, conformal covariance is the same thing as conformal invariance of them as some differential forms of some degree. So, well, okay, conformal, if you wish. Okay, so I won't, for lack of time, remind what an Ising model is, so I'll just show a picture of some representation. So that's slide number one. So. Well, you should actually, well, I should have a remote when it goes. Slides, so to say. So this is a loop representation. Of Fortuyn-Kestelen random cluster model. And, as you see, I fixed some domain, and I take all loop collections which are so to say, Hamiltonian loop collection, so they include all edges, and loops don't intersect, so they can touch the vertices, but I push them a little bit apart. And I have to specify what is the probability of configuration. So I say that the partition function is equal to the sum of all configurations of a square root of q to the power number of loops, where q is the parameter. In our case, we're interested in the range between 0 and 4, because this will lead to things which are conformally invariant or conjecturally conformally invariant. So this writing means that probability of a given configuration is square root of q to the power number of loops. In this case, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 loops, so square root of q to the power 6, divided by the sum over all possible configurations. So that's probability of a configuration. Now, how is it related to the original Ising model? So first of all, this is at criticality, so that's it, the critical temperature. So if you do loop representation at non-critical temperature, then it goes a little bit awkward. There is some additional term here. And what you do Ising model on this lattice, which is rotated 45 degrees, which is marked by small crosses of whatever color. And then you do spin Ising model on there, so you get some clusters, and then you perform percolation on every of the clusters at certain critical value of p, and the clusters which you get then, you forget about the original spins, are the cluster in this model. So for example, here the clusters, well this is one point cluster, but there are clusters which look like that, so this is an example of a cluster, this a very big one. Okay, but, if you do. And then you can do also the same thing on the dual lattice, so that's the lattice which is not marked by crosses. And then the loops I pictured are the interfaces between clusters and the clusters on the dual lattice. So if I picture them, well, I can make picture them in the dual lattice as well, so it's just things which separate those guys. And it turns out that the weight in the original Ising model, if you rewrite it in terms of loops with the use of Euler formula, then you get this formula. So we will just keep this combinatorial and well-known part, and we'll work with that. And the other thing which we need, for some reasons, we will need, sometimes it's called ablution boundary conditions. We need somehow to single out one interface. And to this effect, we introduce a source at A and a sink at B, so we sort of force that there is a curve which goes from A to B. And on the original lattice, it would correspond to saying that you wire the arc from A to B on the lattice, so this is one giant cluster, and you wire the arc from B to A on a dual lattice. So those would be boundary conditions on the original lattice, which introduce that. And the reason why we need to do that, for the second part, we need to show convergence to SLE. But for the first part, we need to find some conformally invariant observable. And if I just look at the domain, there are no non-trivial conformal parameter, no non-trivial conformal model. So I need to put in some points. So now the question is how you find something which is in the limit conformally invariant. There are many conformal invariants which admit nice discretization, but it seems to me that, well, at least that's the case in all the problems which we have on this blackboard, the best idea is to find some function which is discrete, analytic or discrete harmonic with given boundary values. Well, first of all, any other conformal invariant, be that modulus of some Surriemann surface or extremal length, you can rewrite in terms of harmonic functions with given boundary values and some of their properties. Secondly, this is an easy object to work with because you only ask that your function is satisfies something on the boundary and plus some local condition inside. So discrete harmonic usually means that value at every vertex is a mean of the values of its neighbors. Discrete analytic, which is just discretization of repression being equal to zero. So discrete analytic would usually mean that some discretization of Cauchy-Riemann equation is equal to zero. So the most canonical one would be something like that you ask, say, for a function on a square lattice to satisfy the following property that the difference of the function like this is equal to I times the difference like that. And that's exactly the same property as that this is a vector alpha, this is a vector I alpha, this is the same property as derivative in the direction alpha of f is times I is derivative in the direction I alpha. So you can ask this question, this condition to be true, and then in the limit you will get something discrete analytic. So we will ask for some a little bit different form of this condition. But first I have to say what will be the thing which is discrete analytic and the limit is analytic. So this is the function f of z, which is roughly speaking is defined as a probability that this interface, which is pictured in orange, passes through the points. But if we do this, that's not very interesting, so we introduce some complex weight. So it's the probability, or let's say expectation, that z belongs to this interface gamma, right, gamma on top of it. So there is this point z, let's say, somewhere here. So we can consider z to be, I don't know, on edges or in vertices, just some place where these things pass through. And then there is a complex weight, w, z, and gamma. And the weight does the following thing. We trace our curve from b to the point z and count how many turns it makes. So in this particular case, it turned by minus 90 degrees. So the weight is some complex number to the power number of turns. So for the number which one should take is the exponent of I times 4k minus 1 times this winding measured in radians. And k should be taken such that k is 1 over 2 pi r cosine of square root of q over 2. So I don't know, I guess I have to say, so this theoretically should work for all Q state spots models for all values of Q. It works for easing and it works for uniform spanning tree. So maybe I should make here two remarks. So I make them on the left blackboard. So that's, so if you take Q equal to zero, then you get uniform spanning tree, because what happens if you take q equal to 0, then you have 0 to the power number of loops, so you don't have any loops, because if you have one loop, then the weight of configuration is 0. So you just have a space filling curve from A to B, and this is the curve which is the boundary of uniform spanning tree rooted on AB, so that's the curve which converges to a CV8 by Lorentz round Werner. And for q equal to 2, you get random quasi representation of Ising. In general, for q equal q, you get random quasi representation of q state pots model. And for q equal 1, you get percolation on square lattice. Bond percolation on square lattice. So, this, what I'm saying, it should work for all q, but it, well, as of today's morning, it only works for uniform spanning tree, for which we already know for quite some time that it's conformally invariant, but it also works for q equal 2. And well, there are two questions. First question: so what is the statement about the analyticity of this guy? And the second question is how one arrives at this guy. So there are several motivations how one can arrive at exactly this thing. So, for example, one can start from the SLE end, and one can look at what different observables, like probability that SLE passes through a point taken with some sign, how do they look like? Because for SLE, such things you can compute exactly. Then you compute them exactly, you notice that they are, say, analytic with given boundary values, and then you try to find something here which has the same boundary values. Another option is that you can go back, say, to Coulomb-Gass papers of Nienhaus and others, and there are very similar things which are considered. So this can be, so it's sort of a combination of order disorder operators, and this can be viewed, because we already had height functions mentioned in this conference, so we can view this picture as a geographic landscape, where every loop is sort of a curve where the height is equal to some constant. And then the weight per loop is square root of q. And then we can orient the loops, because if we don't orient them, we don't know whether this is a hill or whether this is a hole. So if we orient loops, then the weight per loop is square root of q over 2, because there are two possible orientations. But another way is to make some complex weight per loop, say weight mu, so that for one orientation it's mu, and for another it's mu bar, such that mu plus mu bar is equal to square root of q. And what one does in this case, one can also, one orients the curve from A to B, which goes in one direction, but then what we can do, we can stop this curve at Z and reverse orientation of half of it. So we reverse orientation of half of it. And then if reverse orientation of half of it, then it's no longer that this curve winds from A to B and gives us the same winding, zero, but there is one half which does some number of turns, and there is another half which does the same number of turns. So for example, in this picture, it's 90 degrees for this half and 90 for the other. So we should weight it as a cycle with 180 degrees turn. And this is the complex weight which one then should give. So there is some physics motivation for that, which I don't want to get into. And there are also, if you try to combinatorially check for which values of W you would get discrete analyticity, then it will be the only this weight W. So now I want to state the theorem. So first of all, I want to make another remark. So what this weight means for the Ising model. So for the Ising model, q is equal to 2. So you have square root of 2 over 2. And arccosine of this is 45 degrees. So k is 45 degrees, k is 1 over 8. And here you have essentially, you have the following number. Maybe I'll just draw a picture. So what happens if we pass through the same point with no twist, with a twist of half a turn and with a twist of a full turn? So this picture will give us weight 1. This picture will give us weight minus I. And this picture will give us weight minus 1. Because if you plug in, for example, k equal to 1 over 8 here, you get minus 1 half, and the full twist is 2 pi, so we get minus 1 half of 2 pi, so we get minus pi, so exponent of minus pi is minus 1. So essentially you can just say that this is the weight, that each full turn gives you a factor of minus 1. And if you have, it's not visible here, Well, okay, maybe then I reproduce it. There, so if you have three pictures, like this, like that, and like this, so this is only, so that's remark two for the EZIC model. So here is weight is equal to 1, here weight is equal to minus I, and here weight is equal to minus 1, and so on and so on and so on. Okay, so now the theorem of proposition, I don't know. So the proposition f of z is discrete analytic, discrete homomorphic. And on the boundary, imaginary part of f of z times the tangent vector, square root of tangent vector, is equal to 0. So f of z times square root of tangent vector is equal to 0 on the boundary. What do I mean by discrete analytic? Well, the usual definition is also satisfied. So if you restrict f to horizontal edges, if you just look at f on horizontal edges, and you compare the values at these four neighboring edges, then the difference like that is equal to difference like this times I. So there is also a usual definition of analyticity here, but there is the one definition one actually uses is slightly different. But there is just some local difference relation which in the limit is analyticity. And on the boundary you have this property. Now, what do I mean by this property? So as this picture above shows, through the very same point I can pass with different complex weights. So through a vertex, for example, I can pass with weight 1 or weight minus I. So as an expectation I can get any complex number. Through an edge, it's slightly different because through an edge you can only pass in one direction. So if I'm speaking about a given edge, say this edge, then either you have only odd pictures or only even pictures. That's some for reasons of parity. But still, you can get either positive number or negative number. Now, what happens with an edge here on the boundary of the domain? I can only go in one direction. And the reason is because my curve cannot intersect the boundary of the domain. So if I approach to this point, then I make the same number of turns, then the boundary of the domain makes up to this point. But the weight I take is essentially this weight 1/2. So essentially to count how many turns boundary makes, I should take the square root of tangent. So this is the condition. Maybe the third remark I want to make here, the continuum envelope of this would be the function f small equal to square root of phi prime of z, where phi is the conformal map of my domain to a horizontal strip of width 1. Why? Because, this map phi is analytic, because it's a conformal map. And if you go on the boundary, then the imaginary part of phi doesn't change. Then if you differentiate along the boundary, you get exactly that imaginary part of square root of phi prime times square root of tau doesn't change. So you get exactly this condition. Is it clear, or should I maybe say more? It's because, phi, imaginary part of phi is equal to constant on the omega, and then phi prime, what is it on the omega? It's basically d phi dz. On the omega here, if we here on the picture on the right, it's something completely real. So you get that it's purely imaginary thing, and then you get a square root. So this is the continuum analog, and the theorem is that as mesh of the lattice goes to zero, f of z converges to this guy. Uniformly inside the domain omega. And now there is only one thing, is that we differentiate, but here we differentiate in the plane, and here we differentiate on the lattice, taking lattice differences. And to get the real derivative, we have to divide by the lattice mesh. And then we take square root, so the theorem is that here you should put 1 over square root of mesh. But well, this sort of a physicist should know that it's one of the exponents in the easing model, so you should normalize by that. Okay. So now maybe I want to say just a few words how one proves this proposition and how one proves this theorem. Let's say proof. So for the proposition. So what do you, question, yes? None. If you have a regular boundary, then you also have convergence near the boundary. Then you have also convergence in the boundaries. So for example, if you have smooth boundary, well, say, horizontal boundary, then there is this convergence, so you get the limit of this guy on the boundary, the twist is always fixed, so you get just probability that your point is on a curve, which is probability that the cluster touches it, which in the original model is magnetization. So you get that the dimension of the cluster intersected with boundary is 1/2, which was of course computed back, I think, for the boundary points, it was by McCoy and Wu, or I don't remember, not by Anzaghi, but by someone later, probably by Wu. Okay, so if boundary is smooth, then you can also get convergence on the boundary, but to get convergence inside, you don't need any assumptions here. Okay, so the proof of the proposition, it goes like that, that we just, well, with the boundary, I already explained why you should have some property like that on the boundary. The question is why you have some discrete analyticity property. So let me look at two edges, four edges actually, which emanate from some vertex, and let me label them east, east, west, north, and south. So the first observation, as I said, this curve, if it arrives, well, this curve, you see, it has this, what is this color? Blue.
Blue.
So this curve always has blue on the left. So it can arrive to a given edge only from one direction. So if it arrives from some direction, the only other possibilities for twist is this twist plus 360 plus 720, etc., etc. So if we have some weight for this edge, then the other possibility, so weight is this weight times minus 1 times plus 1 and so on and so on. So on every h, argument of our function is defined up to pi. So suppose that here, for example, for the eastern h, the argument is 1. Then for the northern h, you make one turn right. So the argument would change by square root of I, because just one turn right is I. I bar in this formula, and then, well, so it's there is power, this coefficient 1/2 here, and here it's a multiple of I, and here it's a multiple of square root of I bar. Or in terms of arguments, maybe you can put in terms of arguments, in terms of arguments, the argument will be 0, pi over 4, pi over 2, and 3 pi over 4, plus some multiple of pi. And now what I claim is that, essentially you here have for real functions, not for complex functions, because for each of them the argument is determined. And apparently we have two relations which can be written like that, f of north plus f of south is equal to f of east plus f of west. So this is the relation we have. And since you have two complex numbers, that gives you two real relations for real functions, and if you look at the lattice, it will give you exactly as many relations as you have functions. So it should determine the functions uniquely. So how this is proved? You just look at possible contributions to these guys from curves passing through this vertex. If curve doesn't pass through this vertex, it doesn't contribute to any of the four edges. If it passes through the vertex, what you can do with this curve, suppose that the curve goes like that, you can rearrange what happens at this vertex. And if you rearrange what happens at this vertex, then you get from every possible passage two pictures. On one picture it will pass only once, on the rearranged picture it will pass twice. But the left picture will have additional factor of square root of q in weight because there is one cycle more. Now suppose that this picture contributes a factor of x, and this would contribute a factor of x square root of q. And now I'll just write what these pictures contribute. So this is south, and the left picture is contributed, let's say, x square root of q. It doesn't contribute anything to the north. it doesn't contribute anything to the east. But to the west, it again contributes x square root of q. But the trick is that we made a turn left. So we have to multiply by the weight of this turn. And the weight of this turn, let me make it denoted by lambda. So it's this square root of I, square root of minus I, whatever that was. Yeah, square root of minus I, so it's exponent of minus I, pi over 4. So here, there is this guy. And then you do the same thing here, that here, if you have here contribution x, then for east, you have contribution, you made one turn right, so it's x lambda bar. For north, you made one turn right, one turn left, one turn left, one turn left, so made two turns left. So therefore, the north, the contribution is x lambda squared. And here you made two turns right, three turns left, so the total is one turn left, so the contribution is x lambda. So in either of these identities, there is no identity. But if you add them together, if you add and put all these two configurations together, it will sum up to zero. So one only has to check that lambda squared plus 1 plus square root of q in our case is square root of 2, is equal to lambda plus square root of 2 lambda. And this is an easy trigonometry exercise for this number. So maybe I'll leave it at that. So so this is how the preposition is proved. And
Sorry? Is that also what singles out q equals 2?
No, because if you have a different value of q, you have different value of lambda. So this works for any value of q and lambda, what I said. But what singles out q equal 2 with this particular presentation, not in the way how it is written, but how I present it here, is that without the values of lambda, you would have not a real number here, but a complex number here, because you would have not 1 minus I minus 1, but you would have here some other complex number for the other value of lambda. So for the other values of lambda, you would have four complex numbers and one complex relation, and that's just not enough. But you can dig up, well, there are some other relations in the quadrant, so it's not as bad as I say, but not enough, unfortunately. Okay. And the proof of the theorem, so the proof of the theorem is that it's a bit inconvenient condition to work with. Instead of working with f, we work with what should converge to phi prime. So if we know that f is sort of related to square root of phi prime, then we know that the integral of f squared is related to phi. In particular, imaginary part of the integral of f squared is related to imaginary part of phi. An imaginary part of phi is a function, harmonic function, which is 0 here and 1 here. So for such function, there would be no problems with convergence. If you have a harmonic function, discrete harmonic function, which solves the Dirichlet problem 0 here, 1 here, it's a 85-year-old theorem that it would converge. And you should work with that. Of course, unfortunate thing is that f is discrete analytic, so you can integrate it. But square of f is no longer discrete analytic. It's not like with analytic functions you can square it. So the square is only approximately discrete analytic, so you can't integrate it exactly. But for some miraculous reason, that's sort of a magic of Ising model, imaginary part of integral is well defined and is approximately harmonic. So the way this works, that you define function h of z, which is essentially should be thought of as imaginary part of integral of f of z squared. So dz. So it's defined by this property that so here it's probably not visible. So if it's defined by the property that if you have two neighboring squares, and one of them is, let's say, blue square and another non-blue square. So if you have two neighboring squares and one of them is blue and the other is, let's say, non-blue, then what you write that h of the blue square minus h of the other square is equal to absolute value of f on this h. So it sounds a little bit funny definition, but if you look carefully, because on different edges f has different arguments. And if you examine it carefully, it turns out that exactly what one should do to integrate f squared dz and take imaginary part. One should do exactly this. And then you also notice that when you pass from non-blue to blue, h always increases. But then when you pass back to non-blue, it again decreases. So you have these two copies of functions on the original lattice and the original dual lattice. And one of them is bigger than the other, but the difference is small. And also it turns out that one of them will be harmonic on the new lattice and another subharmonic, and that's how it works. So this is the definition of function h, and h is approximately harmonic. So h is approximately harmonic, and it and h converges to imaginary part of phi. So by the way, it's really easy to see that h is well defined, because to get that h is well defined, you have to show that when you walk around a vertex, then you get to the same value. That and each time you either add f squared or subtract f squared. So this here you add f squared, and here you subtract f squared. So we need to show that sum of those two squares is equal to sum of these two squares. But those are two orthogonal vectors, because they are real and imaginary. And those are two orthogonal vectors. So by Pythagoras' theorem, the sum of these two squares is equal to the sum of those two squares. So h is well defined. And the slightly more difficult calculation shows that it's approximately harmonic. Well, in this case, it means the following, that h restricted to blue vertices is subharmonic, h restricted to white vertices is superharmonic, and the difference is more than epsilon. Meaning that if you have two sub and superharmonic functions which are epsilon closed, then they're approximately harmonic.
In the interior.
In the interior, yeah. Well, the epsilon falls everywhere. The epsilon falls everywhere. Yeah. I can explain later, but it's basically falls from magnetization being zero. Because anywhere, if you're close to this part of the boundary, then there is a cluster reaching from the lower part of the boundary. If you are at this point of the boundary, then there is anti-cluster reaching from above. When you write the definition of f. So either way, the thing is small. So you just need to know that f tends to zero in the limit. And it does. Okay. So now I promise to explain how from this one gets that the limit of one interface is a CLE, and the limit of the whole collection of interfaces is also conformally invariant. So the limit of one interface, what you do, you look at this function f of z. Well, I mean, first of all, you do some a priori estimate. So you get enough a priori estimates to show that these curves, they have stochastically bounded Herder norms. So these random curves, they form a compact, some precompact sequence. So there is a converging subsequence. So to show that these curves converge to a CLE, it's sufficient to show that a converging subsequence converges to a CLE. So we take a converging subsequence, it converges to something, we map this something to half plane, we describe it with Lovner evolution, it has some random driving force, not a Markov process, not a diffusion, just some random driving force, and we want to show that this is a Brownian motion. And then one utilizes the same martingale trick as for uniform spanning tree by Lorentz, Schramm, Werner. It would work in any of the mentioned situations. So this works like that. So let me maybe write it here, so this will not fit anymore. So by compactness, this curve gamma with mesh J converges to some curve gamma. Then we describe it by Lovner evolution, and I don't define what that is. I just say that Lovner evolution, well, map half plane described by Lovner evolution. I just say that there is some equation for the map GT, and the map GT maps this curve up to time t to half plane, and the tip of the curve goes to zero, and then the GT has expansion at infinity z minus driving force plus 2t over z plus etc. And we are after this driving force. And what do we know? Well, we know that this thing has a conformally invariant scaling limit. But also we know that this thing, like probability passing through a Z, is defined to be a martingale with respect to this curve. So by the total probability, total expectation formula, F at some point Z, let's say, f of point z is equal to the expectation over all possible trajectories up to time t of f, conditional f, given this trajectory, which is just f in this new domain with this. So this is just by total probability formula.
How do you know that f has the martingale property?
Oh, it's just the way it's defined. The probability that you pass through a curve will be, because you see, the thing with this nearest neighbor interaction models is that they, when you draw the curve up to some time, it doesn't distinguish it from the boundary of the domain. When I take away this curve, the partition function is just the same. I didn't ruin any loops. So this is why this setup only works nicely in that case. And f is square root of phi prime, and what is phi here? It's a map of a half plane to S3. So what maps half plane to S3?
No one knows.
It's in the exponential logarithm, I don't remember. Which one? So it's a logarithm, let's assume that we have here power 1 pi, but let's assume that we have power sigma. So more general power, because that's what you're supposed to have for other models. So you have this, and you should have logarithm of this to the power sigma. What do you have on the right? On the right, you have expectation of the very same thing, but the map which maps to a strip is first you have to apply gt, and then you have to apply logarithm. So logarithm of gt of z prime to the power sigma. And logarithm pi is 1 over z to the power sigma. And on the right, you also, that's not quite useful because it has map gt, which is a very complicated object, but you plug in this expansion. So we plug in this expansion, and we take z very, very large. And then we get some series here in z. So I will just write the answer, what the series is. So you get the expectation of I will factor out 1 over z to the power sigma. And the expectation will be, so it's 1 plus sigma over z wt plus sigma times sigma plus 1 over twice z squared wt squared minus 8t over sigma plus 1 plus etc. So you have two series which are equal, and one is trivial and the other is not trivial. So equating them, we get the coefficients are equal to 0. So essentially, you get that expectation of wt, expectation of this, are equal to 0. And you can also do the same thing, stopping twice at time t and the time s. And you get essentially that that wt and wt squared minus 8t over sigma plus 1 are martingales. Because you can do the same thing for their increments. Mm-hmm. And that, by Lewis theorem, implies that that wc is a Brownian motion, square root of kappa Brownian motion, where kappa is 8c over sigma plus 1. Now, if sigma is 1 half, like in our case, then kappa is 16 over 3. So we get the number we expected.
It's 8 over sigma plus 1.
Yeah.
No, we don't want a t. In the up, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, it's time independent. Okay, now the question is, what you do for the full loop collection. Yeah, that's it's supposed to work. That part would work for any model as long as you have some a priori estimates and they're easy to attain for Ising model, and as long as you have discrete analyticity of this function f, which for now I only have for those two. Now, okay, so that's one more slide. So there are several ways how one can instruct the full loop collection. So I was thinking for a long time which way I prefer, and I prefer the way with the tree, because first, Scott Sheffield has written a very nice paper about this tree in the continuum case, and it's very nice to make connection to it. Secondly, the way I arrive at it is more constructive than Scott does. So it sort of nicely complements Scott's paper, because some places it shows why he's doing what he's doing. Because if I read his paper, for me it seems to be sort of very difficult to arrive at what he does in some places, but here you're sort of forced to do similar thing automatically. And the third thing is that I looked at these trees I started looking at trees for very different reasons, because I wanted to make this work for all models. And it seemed very possible that you should put some weight not only on this curve but also on the cycles. But if you put that on the cycles and you include winding, you should have a reference point for every cycle. And the logical way is to attach the cycles to the curve. And there are several canonical ways to attach to the curve, probably like three. And it seems that there is one which is better than the others, and that's the one Scott does. So the way goes like this. So we want to reach every point. So I will just write. So the tree, again, we have A and B for boundary conditions. And the tree is the union of branches for all points C. And the branch at point C is obtained in the following way. So I want to use my picture to get from A to C. So suppose I have a point C here. Then I just drive leisurely until I hit C. Now suppose C is not on this curve. Suppose C is somewhere else. Then I drive leisurely and I still don't know. I might still arrive to C. And then when I made the turn here, I'm completely lost. So I made some printout on Yahoo Maps and I took the wrong turn and now I will never arrive to C. So I have to retrace myself back to the point where I made the wrong turn and I jump to a cycle. Well, there is some freedom here whether you in which direction you follow this cycle. You can always choose to follow the same direction. You could do some probabilistic thing, say tossing a coin, and then I turn to the cycle and arrive to C. So it can be more complicated if I have point C here, for example, then I'm driving till I hit this point and C is cut off and I have to follow this cycle and here I have to jump, I have to follow this cycle, here I have to jump. So sometimes you have to make a lot of jumps. So branch C is just what I said. And then there is a very nice process. It all is explained nicely in Scott's paper in the continuum setting, what you do. And of course, probably motivation is this, that you start with the lattice model. What a very important property is that branch for C is equal to branch for C prime as long as it doesn't separate C and C prime. So if we are driving to two points C prime here and C there, we use exactly the same route up to the point where we separated those two. So here in this point, C is to the left, C prime is to the right, so they split. So what happens is that two branches are exactly the same until we split separate two points, but once we separate, they are completely independent because they do these processes in two different disjoint domains. So the branches are coupled very nicely. So I hope that Scott would have explained this in his talk, but I think he didn't get to this point because of the questions. So, you can read his paper. And now it appears because they are coupled in this nice, up to separation, in this nice way, it's enough to describe the law of one branch. And it turns out that you could do exactly the same thing to describe a law of one branch. So it turns out that a variation on this observable is a martingale with respect to a branch and has a conformally invariant scaling tree. So I have 1 minute to do that. And maybe I'll just write what is this variation is. So let's look at the slide here. So what you do, so I will write it for a C on the boundary because it's easier for C on the boundary, and if you do 3, 4 points C on the boundary, you retrieve all the cycles which touch the boundary, and that's basically enough to get the whole picture by iteration. So you have this picture, let's say A, B, and then there is this HC. So you split, you cut this H, so you have two now points here, let's say C1 and C2. And then you have here two sources and two sinks. So if you look at this model, there are two possible pictures. There is a picture like this, or there is a picture like that. So what you do exactly the same expectation with exactly the same thing, and you do it for those two curves, but you use those both curves. And in the lower picture, use only one curve, but you take a weight square root of two. So there are several different combinations like that which would work, but there are essentially three linearly independent, there are a few linearly independent combinations which would work, and this also can be viewed as if you do, so this can also be viewed as if you do process from C1 to C2 with sort of imagining that if by chance you slammed into A, then you reemerge at B. So it can be also viewed as if you do this on the lattice, but with an additional H from A to B. Or you can just do this picture. And then what happens that this thing, so let's say the new function f of z, which now has three boundary points, so if you map the whole picture to so that the three points go to infinity, 0, and let's say p, then f of z goes 1 over square root of mesh of the lattice. It goes to the function z plus pi over 4 logarithm 1 minus pi over z. So this part is exactly what we had before, because this part is a mapping to a strip, where those two points are mapped to the endpoints of the strip. But since we have an additional point where we do something, of course there is an additional term coming from this point. And this is that term. So this turns out to be Martingale. There is also another Martingale we actually have to use too. And then when you do the Martingale, well, there is another one. And when you do the Martingale trick, you get two conditions. You get condition that Pt to the minus At is a Martingale. But it's not a Brownian notion with a speed 8, because another thing which is a Martingale is the square root of Pt plus minus. So Pt will from time to time slam into 0. So whenever you are at this point, whenever I restarted the process at this point, I restarted it here, and my points A and B, they jumped here. So they jumped to one point. So P collapsed to 0. So what I mean by plus minus square root of Pt, I mean that whenever they collapse, you choose randomly which sign it takes. So these two things are Martingales. And then, this uniquely determines what is a process Pt. So it turns out that it's some sort of it can be defined as a version of a Bessel process. So if you write it in terms of drifts, maybe I'll just write it it's not visible here. Or is it? Well, I write it where it's not visible. dBt is square root of 16 over 3 dBt. Plus 4/3 over Pt dt. So the difference, Scott writes the same formula, but there is a delicate point here what the process does when it slams it to 0. Because you can write this away from 0, but then you have to decide what you do when you go to 0. And here what happens is that if you know that those two things are Martingale, that uniquely determines what happens when you go into 0. Maybe I'm doing it wrong.
See, I got lost at 0. Could you say that again?
Well, because this process hits 0 every time we try to make a wrong turn. Mm-hmm. So in the scaling limit, there is this counter set of times where you go into 0. And if I just write equations like that, well, it's like I give a generator of a process, which is a symmetric operator, but not self-adjoint, because there is this non-trivial indices at 0. So you have to decide what you do at 0. Well, and this determines it uniquely.
I see, okay, right.
Otherwise, you have some freedom, which more or less says how you decide whether you go left or right, and because besides canonical things, you always go left, you always go right, or you toss a coin. There are also some non-canonical things that you look at the stars at this moment and you decide where you turn, or you ask your companion where you go and on the road, you know. Maybe it's so that it's more clear what you do there. Oh, I'm over time anyway. Yeah, maybe I'm just stop here. Yeah.